me and him, what should we say? Like our education.
I did too much on
Wednesday. So I'd like to call this historic first meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order this February 2nd, 2017. And welcome, everybody, to this committee, and certainly welcome to the members, and thank you for your willingness to serve in this adventure. Since this is a new committee, we'll call it adventure because that's what it'll be. I know we'll do good work, though. So first, what I'll do is just ask each member to identify themselves, where you're from, and if you want to make another couple of comments about what you expect. So, Representative Malmstrom, would you like to start?
Okay. Well, I'm Sherry Malmstrom, and I am representing House District 27, which is Beaverton and Southwest Portland. I was real excited to be on this committee because I spent the last 31 and a half years as a public health nurse specializing in early childhood. So, anyway, that's my background.
Seemed like a good appointment. Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Kennegeyer, House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland, and I feel the same as Representative Malmstrom. I spent much of my career in this area. I know many of you in the room from many years ago, both as a funder with Northwest Health Foundation, Penny Family Fund, and Hannah Anderson Children's Foundation, and Portland Children's Levy, and Multnomah County Commission on families, children, families, and community. Funding programs, visiting programs, it's a huge passion of mine, and I'm really delighted that the speaker developed a new committee to give it special focus, because sometimes it gets lost when it's embedded in other committees, and I think it's really a testament to how important this issue is that she gave it a special focus. So delighted to serve on this committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
Should we wait for a second?
Okay, let's wait for Representative Hayden.
We're going to put you on the spot.
Sorry.
So we're introducing ourselves, Representative Hayden, just talking about where we're from and any little comments you want to make about this committee.
I'm up?
Yes,
you're
you are.
Up.
Well, I'm Representative Cedric Hayden. I'm very excited to be on this committee. I actually got to switch from higher education to this committee, which I enjoyed higher education, but I'm excited about this also. I have the opportunity to serve as vice chair of healthcare, which meets from noon till 1. And that's what I just came out of. That committee doesn't, but that's when we do our organizational stuff. So, yeah, really looking forward to working on issues, particularly in the early childhood development with our ERDC programs, promise to preschool programs that we have, and our promise with Head Start programs that we do. So bringing those all together and trying to make them efficient is going to be fun
and challenging. My turn?
Your turn.
I'm Jody Hack, and I represent South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And I think I kind of transitioned from Education Committee over here along with a few of my other colleagues. And I have been and will continue to always be a huge advocate for early learning and family support services. I don't believe we're going to move the dial on our absenteeism nor our graduation rates until we stay focused and continue to do that work. So I will continue to be a huge voice for the work that we do, and I am absolutely excited to watch us as we continue this work and kind of define what this committee is going to look like. And I too am very excited that the speaker decided to really make this a priority, and look forward to see the definition of where we're going to go and how we're going to do that work. So, and I'm excited to work with all of you, because there's a lot of you that haven't had the opportunity to do that with. So thank you.
Shall we move to the far right, Representative?
You would, Mr. Chair. I'm taking notes here.
Oh.
thank you. I'm David Brock Smith. I am representative from House District 1, which is the beautiful Southwest Oregon Fish Farm and Forestry District. It is from Charleston down to the California border over to West Cape Junction, up I-5 and around, and up to West Roseburg, and then back over, kind of loops around Coos Bay. I'm excited to be on this committee as well and work with all of you. And early learning, of course, is passion of mine. I'm a 7-year school board member and still reside on the Porterford Langlois school board. I'm glad to see the Head Start folks in the audience today. They, of course, my district and area came and spoke to me. Very pleased and happy for what you do. And but I see other opportunities as well. As a former county commissioner, I've dealt with everything from our public and mental health and how we help our youth to the CASA programs and the court-appointed special advocates and the juvenile department and the very sad things that have to go through there. So I'm excited to work with all of you, and I'm really excited that this is a new committee and we have the opportunity to, you know, have a new direction and a path.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Janelle Bynum. I represent House District 51, the beautiful communities of East Portland, Damascus, Gresham, Boring, North Clackamas, and Happy Valley. I'm excited to be here because I am the mom of 4 kids. I've been paying for child care for 15 years now, have another 8 to go. And I believe in the family as the center and focus of our communities. If we're going to be a strong state, we must invest in healthy kids, smart kids, beautiful kids, all the way up to our seniors. And so some of the things even my seniors have told me is that they want to age near their grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And so I really want to make sure that we're doing everything as a state to support our families, support our kids, and support our seniors as well.
Thank you.
John Huffman from the Dalles, and I'm concerned about being on this committee.
You should be too.
Yeah. And let me explain for a lot of you out there that have worked with me for a lot of years. Many of you say, yeah, too many years. Chair Lively sent out a committee welcome a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, talking about how excited he was to have even Rep. Huffman on his on this committee, which I knew he was choking on those words. And so I shot back and I said, oh, my gosh, how did I miss it? What am I doing on this committee? How do I get off? And for those that know me, I was joking, of course. Not a single person responded. And I went, oh, my goodness, this could be a long session. So anyway, glad to be here.
See his response.
My name's Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, which is the majority of Gresham versus the sliver that you have there, Representative. There but there you have. No, happy to be here. Thrilled to. Oh, yeah. So I was supposed to say something about me. Background is law enforcement. So stuff around early childhood development has always resonated with me because when we raise good, strong, healthy children, they are less likely to be victims of crimes or suspects in crimes. So it's my world revolves around crime prevention in that regard. I had the great honor of traveling with Representative Hack. We went to Omaha, Nebraska, and somewhere else that I'm not remembering, but both on the early childhood development and really what we're all working with on at this dais. So happy to be here. A big shout out to my Head Start friends. It's great to see you here. I know you're coming up to the office, but I was a police sergeant that joined the policy council at Head Start many, many years ago and have been a longtime advocate of the work they do. Also, again, with Representative Kenny Geyer, that with the Commission on Children's Families and Communities for hundreds of years. So happy to be here. Happy to be part of. Yeah, I hate to admit it, but it's true. So happy to be here. We're going to do some great things in the really right way.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you. And my name is John Lively. I'm the chosen chair, and I look forward to working with you, all of you. I'm from Springfield, and this is an area I've spent about 20 years so far working in through Lane County and others, and I continue to serve on the Lane Early Learning Council. I've been involved. I think there's tremendous opportunities. I think we've done good work to date, but I think what everybody said is exactly true. There's more we can do, and for me, the exciting part is the longer-term view of what happens to all those people we're able to help change that curve of where things might go. So for those who haven't served with me as a chair, and certainly Representative Huffman and Peluso have, so I tend to perform as respectful but loose. So the important thing is for us to be comfortable with each other and be able to have dialogues and conversations. And yeah, there's times we need to we follow some timelines and things, but for me it's more important that we feel comfortable with having conversations. And the same with our stakeholders when we're talking with stakeholders. And while these often are called hearings, or even in this case it's an informational meeting, to me it's more a chance to have a dialogue and talk what things are. And so the other thing I really encourage members to do, so if there's, you know, ask the questions as we go along, but before we leave each time, if there's something that we've heard during that time that we want to further pursue, or that is a good time to do it when we're all together to have that conversation and bring it up, and Zena will try to capture all of that and keep us on track with doing that. But I really look forward to this work too. I think it's pretty exciting, and we'll have a very fruitful session. So thank you all for serving. So adoption of the committee rules.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Committee rules are modeled after chamber rules. They are identical in each committee for consistency. The 2017 rules are substantially similar to previous sessions, and you have them in front of you, and they're also posted and available on OLIS. So I'll just give a brief summary and touch on key points. A majority of members appointed to the committee shall constitute a quorum for the transaction of business. The chair shall call committee meetings, set agendas, and cause notice of the time and place of the meetings. All meetings shall be open to the public. Testimony shall be taken at hearings, but need not be taken at a work session. The chair may set a time limit on public testimony. In the event that the committee does not complete the scheduled agenda, the items may be carried over to the next scheduled meeting. The speaker may designate subcommittees as deemed necessary and shall appoint the chair and membership of each subcommittee. At the chair's discretion, measures may be either assigned to a subcommittee or retained in a full committee for action. The affirmative vote of a majority of the members of the committee is required to cause a measure to be introduced as sponsored by the committee, table a measure, remove a measure from the table, amend a measure, send a measure to the floor of the House, or approve recommendations. The chair shall schedule a hearing or work session on a measure in possession of the committee upon receipt of a written request signed by the majority of committee members. A motion does not require a second. Proposed amendments to all measures shall bear the appropriate attribution. A minority report shall be subscribed to by at least two committee members who are present and vote in opposition to the committee report. They shall notify the chair and committee staff no later than 2 hours after adjournment of the committee meeting. Any members giving notice shall have until 5 p.m. of the second following business day after giving notice to deliver the minority report, including a legislative council draft to committee staff. Issues contained within a minority report must have been submitted as proposed legislative council amendments and distributed to the committee for possible consideration. Except by a suspension of the rules, a committee may take action on amendments to a measure only after the full text of the amendments have been made publicly available online for at least 1 hour. No measure shall be reported out of committee unless the written legislative council amendments and any fiscal and or revenue impact statements have been distributed and reviewed by the committee. And when involved in an actual or potential conflict of interest, a member shall announce in the committee meeting the nature of the actual or potential conflict prior to voting on the issue giving rise to the conflict.
So the only thing I would say about the committee rules is I would hope that in majority cases we won't have to worry about minority reports and things, but certainly you are always...
Where are you looking at me?
Just wanted to set the stage correctly. Representative Huffman, so any questions about the rules? Are the same rules we operate on others? No questions? Vice Chair?
Chair Lively, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017.
Rep. Peluso moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay. Rules are adopted. So the other thing I'll tell you about a process. So when we vote on measures, that we're passing measures, I prefer we just do a roll call vote every time. That's just a preference of mine. We don't have to, but that's on measures. I normally do that. We don't have a lot of measures yet. We may get more, but still I just think it's important for the public and the stakeholders to know where everybody's at on that. So, okay. We're on. Informational meeting. So, David, are you up? And Sue, Welcome, both of you. And David, it seems like you've been at this quite a while, too. And if you just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Lively, House Early Childhood Family Support Committee. My name is David Mandel. For the record, I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Sue Miller, and I am the Chair of the Early Learning Council.
Thank you. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, do we have the? We have to get it up on the PowerPoint, or you can see it on your screen.
There we go.
Let me just begin by saying just what an honor and pleasure it is for us to be here today for the inaugural and historic meeting of this committee. Just the fact of this committee's existence, I think, is really testament to how seriously this body is taking the issue of supporting our young families and children. I also really appreciate the name of the committee and that equal emphasis on families and family support. So I just wanted to say thank you and to also let you know that you will be seeing a lot of me over the next month. So I think today, you know, we're going to, in some sense, give a pretty high-level overview and a number of the topics I know that we're going to be hitting on today. You'll have a chance to hear more from others and from us as well. But I think there's going to be a number of themes that you'll hear persistently through the work. Family and the centrality of family in all of this. The importance of communities and community supports in all of this. And, you know, I think one of the themes that we will talk about is building a true early learning system. And I really think about that as bringing these parts together so that this work really does work for families and communities. Just wanted to begin by giving you just a tiny legislative history of the Early Learning Council and the Early Learning Division. Council was founded in 2011, and the authorizing legislation for the Early Learning Division was in 2013. That brought together pieces that were in the Employment Department, other parts of the Department of Education, as well as from the Commission on Children and Families. And I mention those parts in part because I think both the vision for the Early Learning Council and for the Early Learning Division, as I was alluding to earlier, is how do we really bring those parts together so that they work in a coherent and holistic way to really support children and families. Also wanted to show you the slide just as a reminder that we're relatively new, but I'm also hoping that you'll see as we move through this that we've been very, very busy and active, and I think in some really exciting ways over the last couple of years. And with that, I'll hand it over to Sue.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm glad everybody's focused on newness because I've only been chair of the council for about 4 months. So I love having that sort of overview for this. I've been involved in early childhood issues for about 20 years and have testified in front of many of you with a relief nursery hat on for 12 years and then early learning hub hat on for about 4 years. So it's good to see you all, but I am honored to be in this position with a statewide perspective and look forward to working with each of you during the session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Comment, sure. Sue? And you brought up a great point, and maybe not today, but in a future meeting, if you could bring together the, you know, both of those histories of relief nursery and early learning hubs and what your vision is, because I'm passionate about relief nurseries and have helped get emerging relief nurseries started and funded.
Yes,
and
have.
So I'd be interested to know how you see those fitting together.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Huffman. That would be a fun vision to share and to get input on as well, because many of you also have a long history in this arena, so I think this collaborative approach is going to be a really exciting one for this session. So I look forward to that. Thank you. So I want to talk about the Early Learning Council for a few minutes. We are the policy-making body for early learning system. And the first bullet talks about oversee a unified system of early childhood services. And if you jump down to the fourth bullet, you will see what an aggressive goal and target that is. Because when we talk about a system, we're talking about healthcare being a part of it, K-12 being a part of it, human services, so the whole DHS constellation being a part, and then also the business and community voices. So that's, for me, that's the really exciting part. That's the transformative part. We've all been working with early childhood programs for years, kind of in our own arenas. You know, they're called silos, but I think that's a little harsh. But now the challenge for all of us is to see how do those overlap. And having a number of you here who have the K-12 and the healthcare backgrounds will really, I think, be informative for all of us. So we do rulemaking, and we are focused on children who are at risk of arriving at school unprepared for kindergarten. And I'll talk in a couple of minutes about that focus population that we have been charged to look at. So we obviously work very closely with our staff and with David as our acting director, and each member of the council has been appointed by the governor. The goals of our council, and I'm guessing these are not new to you, that children arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed, families are healthy, stable, and attached, and the early learning system is coordinated, aligned, and family-centered. So I'm sure we'll figure all those out by the end of the session, and we'll all go home happy. Audacious goals, but also very, very critical. Our council has up to 20 members. Currently, we are at about 14, but I'm expecting a couple more to be appointed soon. The intention is that we be representative of the state. And this lists, you know, it's geographic, ethnic, racial, economic diversity. Also having early childhood professionals on the council. And you will see the next slide shows who is currently serving on the council. And you will see from that that we have the directors of four state agencies, one of which is David, and then also the head of ODE, OHA, and DHS, which reflects that transformation that I'm talking about in the system development. So we're very fortunate to have an outstanding council. And one thing I wanted to mention is the council has four standing committees, and they are child care and education is one, best beginnings, which is sort of our prenatal to age three, an equity implementation committee, and then measuring success, which is our metrics serve accountability committee. And each of those is chaired by a council member, but that is a real opportunity we use to get other people in communities involved and to make sure we've got that statewide representation. So some of those committees have up to 14 to 18 people on them. So I want you to know there's really quite a network that the council has put together in order to inform the council's work and obviously to partner with our staff. So it's bigger, way bigger than just the council. The population we serve. In Oregon, there are approximately 230,000 children under the age of five. Since 45,000 children are born each year, that number is probably changing as we speak. The demographics of those children are listed there, and you can see that we are a diverse state, and as we all know, the diversity is increasing, and I believe we are all celebrating that diversity. The focus population for the Early Learning Council and our work is on the 137,000 children who are of color, with disabilities, living in poverty, geographically isolated, and/or whose first language is not English. So while, ideally we're going to deal with all 45,000 children, we definitely have a focal point that we try to tailor our programs for. And then under population, we serve the another one outside of the children and their families, of course, that we wanted to indicate were the child care providers in our state. And David will go into a lot more detail on this, but we really consider them one of the very pivotal parts of our system and a group of people whom we spend a lot of time working with and learning from and trying to support in the important work they do, as well as the early childhood programs, some of which are represented here today. But we try to be a partner with all of them to serve them and also get their input on the work we do. So that is a very quick overview of the Early Learning Council. I'll turn it back over to David.
Thank you. Sue, I think, hit on some of these themes that I just know that we're going to be continuing to talk about, particularly the work to really build connections across the various systems and to really partner deeply with communities. I did want to start with the mission of the Early Learning Division to support all of Oregon's young children and families to learn and thrive. And when we first created this as our mission statement, one of the responses I heard was, well, supports seems like a kind of weak word. But I think we really stood by supports because I think it puts the emphasis on this is first and foremost about families. It's first and foremost about communities. And our role is to be there to help provide those supports and to make sure that there are resources necessary, the resources are available so that families can thrive and succeed, and so can communities. I just put this up to just give you a little bit of a sense of the scope and scale of the Early Learning Division. I think what it shows you is we're not a huge organization, but we're also not a small one either. Most of our staff are actually folks who work directly with child care programs in licensing and monitoring or working on background checks with that. And then most of the money that we receive actually goes straight out to communities and community-based programs through our special payments. And then we're also, particularly through the Child Care Development Fund, a recipient of a significant amount of federal dollars, and that's actually what supports most of our regulatory work that we do.
David?
Mm-hmm. Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just explain those numbers again? Because clearly they don't add up. And so the budget...
I was hoping that someone would point that out. And the reason that they don't add up is in part because most of that federal funds is a Child Care Development Fund. And currently over 80% of those funds we transfer to the Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. So that's part of the reason those numbers don't match up.
And part of it is that part of both of those blue boxes are passed through and part of it goes to your operational budget?
Right, yes. Well, the special payments are the dollars that we send directly out to and contract with programs. So the special payments is the funds that go directly out to community partners.
So would that mean that your budget is only... really $34 million for your operational budget?
Our operational budget's not that big, yeah. So that's why it helps to put some of those numbers up there.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just wanted to give you a quick overview of some of the key early learning programs that we'll both be talking about today and that you'll be hearing a lot more about. I know that you have informational hearing on the hubs next week, and we're really excited to talk about that. And also opportunity to hear more about home visiting and Head Start and our preschool promise. But I also, those are the programs that the Early Learning Division is responsible for administering, but I also want to emphasize that the early learning system is much bigger than the Early Learning Division, and there's really important key core services and programs that the state provides that are outside of the scope of the Early Learning Division. employment-related daycare that I just mentioned, which is with close collaboration with Department of Human Services, and we'll have a chance to come back and talk to you about that collaboration. Early intervention, early childhood special ed, works with our children before school with special needs, and that's out of a different part of the Department of Education, and Babies First, a home visiting program for Oregon Health Authority. This isn't the full list. I just wanted to give you, just wanted to emphasize both the scope and also, you know, necessary for collaboration across state agencies in this work. So as I mentioned earlier, one of our key responsibilities as the Early Learning Division is for the monitoring and regulation of child care, which means that we are really working with a diverse array of, you know, for the vast majority, small businesses, private programs. Many of this happens in folks' homes, family child care. So we're responsible for conducting background checks, health and safety monitoring, and also addressing complaints and public inquiries. We're also responsible and very active in building up systems of support for child care providers and for early learning programs more generally. We'll have a chance to talk about SPARC and our quality rating improvement system a little bit more, but then we also work with our regional child care resource and referral network that provides direct supports to providers, and we're also responsible for the early childhood professional development, which also includes, you know, partnership with some of our higher ed institutions, and this is something that we're really also having, looking forward to have a chance to talk to you more deeply about in the future, and I think it's a real opportunity moving forward. As I mentioned earlier, most of our work in the area around child care is both financially supported and guided by the Federal Child Care and Development Fund. And the purpose of that fund is to provide assistance to low-income families, funding to improve the quality and safety of child care, and supports increasing the supply and availability for care of all children. I want to flag this in particular because in 2013, for the first time in almost a generation, the bill authorizing a CCDF was reauthorized, and with that came a number of new requirements that we as a division, as well as in partnership with the DHS, are in the process of administering. And one of the things that I know that will come in front of this committee are a couple agency policy bills that are about how we stay in compliance with those rules and continue to receive the approximately $140 million per biennium that we receive from CCDF. So I just wanted to flag that because it's something that's going to be coming back to this committee. So I want to just give you a brief overview, and I know this is a very high-level overview of just, you know, this, but just give you a sense today of the scope of our work. We work in partner to supporting our system of relief nurseries, which really, I think, one of it is actually one of the things exciting about relief nurseries. This is really a homegrown Oregon innovation that's really focused on providing that upfront prevention to prevent to make sure that we reduce the number of children that enter into the foster care system. They provide trauma-informed therapeutic early childhood supports, home visits, parenting supports, working with children under the age of six who are families of children under the age of six who are experiencing risk factors associated with abuse and neglect. I actually did not provide a lot of details today on the program because I thought they were going to have an informational hearing right after us today, so I thought I would let them talk about their great work, but I think they'll be up in a week or two.
2 weeks, maybe.
Yeah, so I think you'll have a chance to hear about the great work that they do in much more detail. We also are responsible for administering one of Oregon's home visiting programs, Healthy Families Oregon. This is a statewide a home visiting program that works with expectant mothers, mothers with young children, and also has that same lens of upfront prevention, building parenting skills, connecting the health and other services to make sure that children are thriving. And that's also something you'll have a chance to hear about more next week.
Representative Huffman, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. David, you mentioned trauma-informed care. To what extent is the department involved in that? Are you training hub directors? I mean, where do you take trauma-informed care and training?
No, that's a really wonderful question, and that's that conversation I think is happening throughout the system. But actually, we quite recently had a meeting with our early learning hubs, and one of the questions that as part of the discussion was where were they interested in getting deeper training and wanting to have more work, and this was at the top of their list. So it is something that's really, I think everyone's sort of converging around those supports. So, and it's one of those things that it's a thread through many pieces, so it's not a thing that you can point to one item and say that's where it's happening, but that's a thread through, you know, trainings that we're working with child care providers. It's something the hubs are really interested in. It's been historically a focus of the relief nurseries.
Okay. I encourage the continued work and maybe even on a greater level than as you get into it. I'm working with Representative Greenlick to have a sanctuary model, ACEs, trauma-informed care presentation to the healthcare committee. Great. And you know, maybe we could organize it to come here too.
Services committee too.
We can make a day.
And I believe there is also some work and a bill coming out of K through 12 on also bringing in trauma informed practices to K through 12 as well. So
great.
One of the programs that we work with Mr. is Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. We have a lot of our Head Start folks in the back of the room, and this is really Oregon's close collaboration with the federal Head Start program. So the federal Head Start is a federal to local program, but we work with basically almost all of the same providers, also receiving state funding through OPK. And really close collaboration. So that's a great example of a sort of community, state, and federal collaboration that's really unique to Oregon. Through current funding between the state and federal funds, able to serve about 62%, about 14,000 of the eligible children, about 8,000 of those are through state funding.
Representative Finnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, can you tell us how many of those are full-time versus part-time?
I don't have those numbers in front of me. Okay. The state funding is for. This is a really interesting, important question because the federal program is trying to encourage and support programs to move to full day. Oregon Pre-Kindergarten has been funded historically as a. I don't want to say half day, but not a full day program. But what we've also done in the state. And this is a long-standing collaboration, is that Head Start and OPK programs have been able to contract with Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare funds in order to expand to a more full-day working day. So we have OPK programs that are offering full-day leveraging are employment-related daycare along with their OPK programs, but I can come back with some more exact numbers.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make the point that many people think of Head Start as a full day. This is going to help people work their way out of poverty, give full support. It's a lot of wraparound services, and it's fabulous, but in many cases, it's a part-time enrichment program, and it can be half day, 3 days a week, 9 months a year. I don't know if that's still true, but anything that we can do to expand it, partner. I know at the Portland Children's Levy, a lot of our subsidizing funding was to try to help fill in that gap so that people could actually go to work and know that they had full coverage.
Yeah. You mentioned something that I was remiss in not calling out, which is really the focus of OPK also on comprehensive services and really strong parent engagement, parent involvement. Hopefully, I know you'll hear from the Head Start Association soon, and you'll get to hear, I'm sure, about the role of the Parent Council and also the other family supports that have really been core to Head Start from its inception.
And the vision screening, health screening,
yes.
Those kinds of
things. Yeah. The state also has a small companion investment into, that works similarly in early Head Start. We only serve about 64 children through the state investment in early Head Start, about another 2,000 children who are served through the federal investment in early Head Start.
Could I ask one more question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as I understand it, that percentage of meeting the need in the early Head Start, 0 to 3, is we're somewhere around 3 to 5%. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've been hovering. I can't remember the exact percentage, but it's basically hovered around there.
Of those who would be eligible for those services.
Right, right. It's much, much smaller percentage than for the services for 3 and 4 year olds. And I think it's a gap that we would all acknowledge that in general, there are fewer services for families with infants and toddlers than for preschool age children. So early Head Start is one of our sort of few center-based models for families with children that age. Or home visiting are another part of that system. But I know that's also something that the council has also talked about as a real priority. How do we also strengthen that support for infants and toddlers? Is there anything you wanted to add on that, Sue? Because I know this is something you've talked about.
Well, when I ran the relief nursery, we had an early Head Start program, so I fully understand the value of it, and I just second what David was saying about, and the council has talked about needing more of that prenatal to age 3. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had a lot of focus on preschool, which is great, and Preschool Promise was a fabulous program that we'll talk about later, but we really need to do the same kind of focus on the earlier piece. And, you know, Healthy Families is the big investment, thank goodness, and home visiting is such an effective way to connect with these families and do the wraparound. And those of you in healthcare certainly know that as well. But I certainly hope part of the vision for this state is that we can enhance those services. I mean, 2 to 4% is embarrassing, is one adjective.
Hope this committee can help with that.
Yes, so do we. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We look forward to working with you on that.
Yes, we do.
So right so far, I've sort of touched on the portfolio programs and supports that the division administers for young children. And I really do think of them in that sense of a portfolio as sort of comprehensive pieces that we all want to work together and bring different kinds of supports for children and families. And as both Sue and I talked about a lot of the charge of that Early Learning Council was to build that integrated early learning system. And one of the pieces that we've been working on in the last few years is to build out some of those key pieces of infrastructure that can really help there be an early learning system. And we were really fortunate that really basically at the same time that the Early Learning Council and the Early Learning Division were formed, Oregon was awarded one of the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenges grants, and that really gave us about $6 million per year that made it possible for us to do some of those infrastructure investments. And unfortunately, that grants ran out this year. We have a no-cost extension, so some of that work is continuing, but the timing was really perfect. And I want to hit on the last part of this presentation, three of our major initiatives that I think are both have been supported by in part by state investments, but also the Race to the Top investments that I think help in a more concrete way show why building an early learning system, what that means, and why it, most importantly, why it matters.
Go ahead. No.
Sorry to keep asking.
Feel free.
Thank you. So the $4.35 million is from the feds. Where is the $6 million from?
So that's the total. The $4.35 billion was the total amount of the race to the top. Of that, we got about 18 to 20 of that was the Oregon Award. So we got about $6 million per year for 3 years.
Okay.
And these were the goals that it supported, looking at how to build up quality child care, increase developmental screenings, build out our professional development system, all with that goal of supporting increased kindergarten readiness. So now I want to talk. I want to talk a little bit about these, some of the major initiatives that we've been doing, and really talk. And I think the goal of really trying to show how this system integration work can make a real difference for children and families. And with that, I'm going to hand it back to Sue to talk about the work of the Early Learning Hubs.
All right. Thank you, David, Mr. Chair, and committee members. I am very passionate about Early Learning Hubs. I helped found the one for Marion and Polk Counties and chaired the board for 3 years and resigned in order to take this position over and didn't want that conflict of interest. But I have seen, up close and personal, the difference that these early learning hubs can make in delivering services for children, even though they don't provide services, but it's that coordination of services. So early learning hubs, they're really collective impact entities. So they're pulling together the partners, and they have common agendas, common measurements, trying to do some pooled and collaborative funding in order to get to agreed upon goals and outcomes. In Oregon, there are a number of different models that are being used to support these early learning hubs. Locally in Marion and Polk County, we have a standalone 501c3. It's the only one in the state that went that direction. Some of them are connected to ESDs. One to community college, one to a community action agency, two are with United Ways, or three are with two United Ways, and a CCO. And it's sort of the beauty and the beast of Oregon, I guess, right? You've seen one hub and you've seen one hub. So we wanted to make sure that people had the flexibility to reflect their own communities, and there's a lot of strength in that, and I think that's really the best way to go. And as you all know, there are some challenges that come with being that flexible as well. So we've got the system. The entire state is now covered by 16 hubs. And I sure hope each of you is familiar with your own in your own region. If you aren't, we'll make sure you are in the near future.
Representative Huffman.
Krista's doing a great job. So Krista Rude, that
yes,
you all know.
You
mentioned that one was connected with CCO, and it got me to thinking, because Krista and I, in our roles, participate with our Gorge CCO. Are the hubs encouraged to be liaisons with their CCOs and be very involved in that healthcare and social determinants of health that all come to play on all these things we're working on?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Huffman, yes, absolutely. It's one of the very specific directives that is given to hubs is to connect with their CCOs. And there's been a lot of work done. The one that is sort of combined is Yamhill. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's a one county, it's a one county CCO, it's a one county hub, it's a one county lots of things. So that's kind of the anomaly for Oregon. But every hub that I'm aware of is connected to their CCO in some way. I know locally, our CCO in Marion and Polk Counties is actually housing the hub and providing the financial and administrative backbone services and doing transformative funding for, screening of young children. And there are some wonderful examples. When the hubs come here for their presentation, I am sure you'll be blown away by some of the examples they can give of how they're working with the CCOs and making a difference in serving kids and their families. Just the bottom line. Thank you for the question.
So why 16 hubs? why not 36 hubs or 20 hubs? Or
Chair Lively, that was the wisdom of this body.
Oh.
That was put into statute in House Bill 2013.
13? Okay.
Yes, said that there shall be 16 hubs and they shall cover the entire state.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. So I've totally not, this is informal, right? So
this
I've
is
totally
fine.
Not followed.
No,
that's
fine.
Actually, because I was on the Human Services Committee that had that bill, my vague recollection was one of this early learning hubs evolved out of the county commission system. And one of the concerns with the county commission system is that there was one for every county, and some of the small counties, it really wasn't a good economy of scale. And so how many CCOs are there, 16 or so? So I think they roughly looked at the region and what small counties could come together, and it seemed like that was a rough number. But then they let the different local entities decide how they wanted to, you know, do they want to do county lines? How do they want to identify themselves? So it was kind of a sorting out process, a little mushy for a while, but we eventually got there.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. And I think in all reality, we actually struggled to get to 16 when we actually put it out. For 16, it was difficult to get 16 quality hubs, and I think we're still not quite there. So while 16 doesn't sound like a whole lot, I think that even that was a pretty lofty place to get. But there's some great ones working, and hopefully they're going to come alongside and help those that might be struggling a little bit.
And that's something we'll get a chance to talk more when they're here, so we can have that and hear that what some of the challenges are for those that haven't quite got there yet.
Right.
The idea is if they're too small, they don't have economy scale. If they're too large, then you lose touch with the local groups that really have a lot of control over where the allocation of resources would go.
You all are identifying some of the challenges, and just operationally, how do you make this work? Mm-hmm. But if we went back a couple of slides, you would see that it's my fault.
We're just driving.
Sorry.
I'll rely on you, Mr. Chair. But what the hubs are needing to do and intending to do is to help identify where are these focus populations that we're trying to connect with, and who are the key partners in their different communities that need to be brought together, who are either already active or haven't traditionally been in the early childhood learning system, you know, and housing is an obvious one that people are more and more focused on now. So, yes. So the work of the hubs is grand, and it's definitely targeted with a population, but collecting data, sharing data, and keeping people at the table and engaged is probably one of the primary challenges, and also assets that the hubs bring. So there you can see where your hubs lie, and all the hubs in the state lie. As David said in the beginning, we're all new. You know, the oldest hub, I think, may be the one here, Marion Polk, which is 3.5 years old, I think. So, you know, we're all new and figuring this out together. But I think I look at it as sort of the microcosm of what we hope we can find at the state level as we watch these hubs learn and grow and become successful. What are the ingredients? And they'll be different in, you know, metro versus rural versus wherever. But I'm confident there are going to be some common denominators that will help us build the statewide system. So those are the hubs, and as you know, you'll be getting a lot more detail in the future. The other one I wanted to just mention, the other initiative, is the Kindergarten Readiness Partnership and Innovation Program. And this was a specific program that the hubs have been implementing, in which the hubs have had an opportunity with some funding, not a lot of funding, but enough funding so that they could pull together some of the, it's really the K K-3 system focused on K. So getting the kindergarten teachers and the principals in elementary schools together with some of the preschool providers and saying, let's do some, you know, common training. Let's have conversations about what do the kindergarten teachers need to see with these little kids coming in, and what do the preschool teachers need in order to provide that support. And that's been a very exciting piece, I know, locally, and I know for many of the hubs, to just see, you know, life is all relationship-based, and to see these professionals recognizing the assets that each of them has as well as the challenges, and how do you put those together to serve these young children. And the schools have really stepped up as far as learning new ways to engage the families. You know, getting those parents in the door, it's relatively easy in preschool because they're still, the kids are so young. Once they go through that school door, I don't know, it gets a little scarier for a lot of people. So I think the early learning system, the early childhood system, has helped some of the elementary schools figure out how do you make it inviting for these new parents with young children, dropping them off at kindergarten, and keep the parents involved. So it's been a great program. Once again, I'm guessing somewhere later this month you'll probably be getting more details about that. And now I'll turn it back to David.
So I wanted to finish up with two last initiatives and talk about the way they connect. Spark, as you may have heard of, our quality reading improvement system. Spark is our rebranding to make QRIS was not the most exciting name. So we do have, I think, a much more inviting way of talking about the work. But if you are familiar with QRIS, you're familiar with Spark. So what Spark is essentially, and I want to go back to, you know, who child care providers are. It's people working out of their home, small small businesses, and often not a lot of access to resources and supports. And so what Spark in large part about, is about providing a framework to help providers think about what a quality program is and provide some concrete steps and about what are changes or improvements or practices that you can make in your program that we know will benefit children and families. It's also a set of supports and coaching to go along with those. But one of the things I think that's also really important and valuable about Spark is the idea is that it's a way of talking about quality and quality looks like that's not associated with one particular program or setting. It's really an opportunity to think about that more broadly. And, you know, I think one of the things... Yeah. One of the things that I always like to say is that what we care about is that children have access to quality early learning experiences. And we know that those quality early learning experiences can happen in all sorts of places. They can happen in a school. They can happen in a Head Start program. They can happen in a child care facility. They can happen with the family. And our interest is supporting making sure those experiences are available, which leads me to Preschool Promise, because I think this is really an opportunity to talk about how things like hubs and Spark converge to really bring about this community-based model of quality early learning experiences for our children and families. This is a brand new preschool program. The legislature last long session created the authorizing legislation for that. First children in classrooms this fall, 1,300 children, 93 sites, serves children up to 200% of poverty. But I think what's really exciting about Preschool Promise is it started with that idea of what we care about is the early learning experiences and not where they happen, and how do we create a public funding model that supports quality but really invests in those diversity of community-based settings. And so two key features of Preschool Promise is we use Spark as part of the shared standards for those shared standards of quality, and the funds flow through the hubs, and the hubs identify and work with the Preschool Promise providers in the community. And I think that component's really key, because what it allows is this work to begin with a community conversation: is who are the children, families that we most, as a community, need to be reaching out and supporting? And then from that question, who are the programs and providers that know those children and families, are working with them, and how do we work with them? And so I think I want to end with that example. You hear much more about it, because I think it is about how the infrastructure work comes together to build that family-centered system that we're all aiming for.
Great. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I have a question. I feel like I should know the answer. So sorry if you've told me this before, but you talked about the partnership between Head Start and OPK as a partnership to expand the federal dollars that we have for Head Start, which is eligibility up to 100%. Is the Preschool Promise, is there any blended funding of Preschool Promise with Head Start programs at all?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And We'll share with you the numbers.
Okay.
It really did. I was really, this was the first year, so you don't know how it's going to look, and it really is that diversity of settings. I can't remember the exact percentage that are of preschool children that are in Head Start sites. I think it's a little out under a quarter, but it is a significant part of that work. I think I'll be honest, as part of our first year of rollout, probably more work to be done in coordinating between hubs and Preschool Promise programs and OPK and Head Start programs. It's something we're working on. But, having hubs allows us to have that conversation.
Representative Hack?
If you have more, go ahead.
Well, I just had a follow-up to that, in that I like that direction of expanding eligibility, because we know that families that are between 100% and 200% are still really struggling. And if the only way that you can qualify for Head Start is by staying under 100%, that means people who are trying to work themselves out of poverty, face that cliff. And so the more that we can ease that and provide support, and I also think there's a lot of studies that show that the more you try to, the more you concentrate poverty, whether it's in child care, K through 12 schools, housing projects, the worse outcomes there are. It's better if you can blend, different economic levels together to the extent possible. So I appreciate the direction that this has been going in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity to visit three of our centers that have the Preschool Promise locally. They were amazing. One had the mixed delivery, so we had Head Start and the Preschool Promise, which was phenomenal. They were functioning great. If I remember right, though, we had some conversation that talked about the 0 to 300%, and I may have misunderstood, or it may have been a different funding mechanism. I probably have to go back and look at my notes. But one of the things I wanted to point out that I think was really, really nice to see, we went to an in-home facility. And she had been Spark. In fact, she was the first one to be Spark certified, I think they called it, out of all of our Preschool Promise facilities in Marion County. She was beyond proud of that. And it was not a typical in-home. I mean, it was, if you have an opportunity, in fact, they invited all of us, if we wanted to take a field trip, to come and tour these three different facilities, to see the mixed delivery, to see one of the sites primarily had, it was a lot of Latino outreach, and they were phenomenal. So I just want to throw that out there. If we're interested, they'd be more than happy to take us on a tour, because it was great to see the differences and the great work they're doing.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing to what Representative Hack was saying. I think one of the things hubs in general, and I know the local one, found specifically, was a great number of in-home care providers who wanted to step up and be a part of Preschool Promise. We had anticipated that kind of the center-based, more traditional, Head Start and relief nurseries and others would be interested, but there was a remarkable response from the in-home providers, and several of them were Spanish is their primary language. So it really did do some of that diversifying that we're all always looking for and trying to figure out how do we operationalize that. So it was a great way to do that.
Representative Lively, Chair Lively, Representative Hack, this is also, I think, a great example of how some of these public investments have been able to build off of each other. The example from Marion Polk, we had also, the legislature had funded focused child care networks where you bring together a cohort of family child care providers together to do shared professional development. There was a Spanish language focused child care network. It was also in part organized around helping those providers get on Spark, and then they were ready in there when Preschool Promise came around. So it was just a great sequence of how those investments, to be honest, really enabled a group of providers who probably would not have otherwise had access, and also serve children and families that we also really want to be connecting with and connecting with in an authentic way.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I have a couple of technical questions. My first is, who qualifies for the ERDC? And what type of person, is it male, female, are they self-employed, employed by someone else? That's the first one. And the second one was I had heard that the expectation for some of the child care providers in Head Start was that they had degrees and how that was playing out, especially in the communities of color.
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum. Let me take these questions separately. On the employment-related daycare, we are going to have a chance to come back and do a longer informational hearing in a couple of weeks. So the federal requirement for the child care subsidies is that they go to low-income families who meet a work requirement. The work requirement is pretty flexible. The state has some degree of the ability to set income limits within that. I believe that the current income eligibility is 185% of federal poverty level. The state also has increase the exit eligibility to be higher than that to help with the cliff effect. Last long legislative session through House Bill 2015, the state also expanded the ability for working parents who are enrolled in higher education to have employment-related daycare cover some of the hours where they're involved in coursework and course study. So I don't know if they fully answered your question. The ins and outs of eligibility get pretty complicated, but in terms of the broad contours. The question around professional development, degrees, and degree requirements has really been a huge one over the last year, in particular in Oregon, a big conversation nationally. So for OPK and Head Start, that follows the federal Head Start performance requirements, and the state put that into statute. So those educational requirements are set through the federal Head Start. They have also been moving and encouraging a higher percentage of Head Start teachers to have bachelor's degrees, and I think that's something the association will probably talk to you more about when they are here. The authorizing legislation for Preschool Promise did require LEAD teachers to have a bachelor's degree, but also gave the council, the Early Learning Council, the ability to grant waivers for that degree requirement. When we come back next week and talk about Preschool Promise, we'll have some exact data on the percentage of teachers that have requested waivers. And there was a strong recognition from the council that, you know, you don't get, if you're working full-time, you don't get a BA in 1 year. That's a really a long, long time commitment. There's also been, I think, a very robust conversation about the interplay between the commitment to professional development and also the commitment to equity, and would that requirement impact the ability of Preschool Promise to really bring in rich diversity of providers and children. I think the waiver has really helped with that, and you'll see that a really high percentage of the teachers have the waiver. But this is also a conversation that I'm really expecting us to have throughout the session. I think there may be some work underway to amend and provide some alternative pathways around that Preschool Promise degree requirement. What I think this whole question has also raised, though, is what are those supports and opportunities for the early learning workforce to be supported? One of the first things I always like to point out about the early learning workforce is not only is it much more diverse than the K-12 workforce, it's actually more diverse than Oregon's adult population, but slightly less diverse than Oregon's 0-5 population. So I think we have a real great opportunity to think about how we build upon and really support that diversity of the early learning workforce as an asset.
Okay, Matt, one more.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of bring that to the top to say that if you expect, let me back up, if you're granting a large number of waivers for something, then that process is broken if people have to waive out of it. That's just a casual observation. And then the second part is, if it costs you, I don't know, $60,000 to get a bachelor's degree, that's not paying you $60,000 in any year, then the value proposition of that degree goes way down, and it slants towards people who have a secondary income that can support you getting that degree. So just food for thought on that.
And I think this intersection between, I think this issue of compensation and supports for the early learning workforce is probably the most important, is speaking from my opinion, of issue that we need to be talking about. It's one of the most challenging. You know, one of the things that I think that was really interesting about Preschool Promise is it also had a salary parity requirement that's part of it. So one of the things that gave us direction as the division to build out a cost model so that we were actually funding programs to be able to pay providers at that rate. And, you know, that is just the start of the conversation, but I think that at least put that issue directly on the table.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Lively, thank you. And thank you for your presentation. Very interesting subject, and something that I'm excited to be about this on this committee. We're going to have fun. But I do have some concerns, and that's why we're going to have fun. So the Preschool Promise, we've got 1,300 people in 9 hubs on that, or students, or however we want to term that. How many are on a waiting list? I'm going to have a couple questions, so I'll just give them to you here. Head Start, same thing. How many are on the waiting list? And geographically, don't have to answer this now, but over the course of the time, I would like to know that geographically that we have somebody looking at that parts of Oregon are being covered equally with other parts of Oregon. Like we've got geographically, if you only have 9 hubs, you know, where are those going for the preschool promise and then the Head Start? And does the Head Start get left a little bit behind, or just the natural adversarial relationship of those two programs trying to come to work together? You already talked about, parity or lack parity of the salaries for the teachers in those two different programs. How many kids are out there? How many are on waiting lists in both those programs? And what are we going to do to make sure geographically across the state, including rural Oregon, has fair representation and participation in both of those programs? Under the ERDC, I was a big, strong supporter of increasing funding for the employment-related daycare, and have been fairly vocal, but now I have a platform to be more vocal about how the zip codes, how the funds of those zip codes are allocated. If you take a zip code in the metropolitan area and you compare that to a more rural area, say Klamath Falls, I don't represent either of those, so I can say that, you have a 2-to-1 cost ratio if the Klamath Falls daycare facility provider can get the certifications to the highest level of what the ones in Portland can be certified for. And there's a question about certification concerns there. But most likely what reality happens is then the folks in rural Oregon have to go to a daycare provider that gets paid, and they're not capable of getting that next step of qualification. And so the parents get a benefit in rural Oregon of either 50 cents on the dollar or 33 cents on the dollar. And then you look at the cost of their daycare, I don't believe that it adds up. So I would like this committee to look at what are the financial analysis being done behind that to support that, rather than three out of every $4 that go to the daycare, 3 of them going to metropolitan areas.
There it is.
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. No, these are, I think along with the issue of compensation, quite related to the issue of compensation in the early learning workforce, is the reality is we know that the providers are both underpaid and parents can't afford it. And this is not a unique reality to Oregon. I mean, this is there's clearly a major gap or market failure in the way in how this works. To be honest, I think part of what drives that more than anything is if you think about the reality of taking care of young children, the adult to child ratios need to be really, really high. And that's fundamentally actually what causes that dynamic, right? Is you don't want one adult with 12 infants in their care at one time. The issue, what you're also referring to, and we can come back, because this will get to be somewhat technical conversation quickly, is the market rate study for setting employment-related daycare reimbursement rates. What we as a state set a goal, and I'm happy that I'm going to have a chance to come back with some of our colleagues from DHS to talk about this together, because I don't want to get the details wrong. What we've set as a goal is wherever you are in the state, the child care subsidy should allow you to purchase a certain percentage of the child care that's out there. And I'm believing it's 75% is where we've set it. So the idea is if you lined up all the child care in a community, the subsidy should be high enough that you could choose 75% of those providers in the community. And that's what the market rate attempts to do, that's part of the reason that it uses group zip codes, is to be able to say, given the market rate in a community, how do we set the child care subsidies so if you lined up all those providers by their price, that a parent with that subsidy could choose at least 75% of those providers. So that's the basis for the market rate study, but we can come back and talk about that some more.
So just quick follow-up.
Okay.
I won't stay on this too long, but this is an important issue to me because you get the market rate studies, and yes, it's getting into the weeds. When we put $60 million into early related daycare or a chunk of money and say, you know, Oregon's going to invest into this, we have no input once those administrative rules get rolling along and they come up with this economic basis. And what I don't like to hear is, well, there's not enough money. I get it. There's not enough money. We can't fund all of it. But with the money that we set aside, we need to be fair to all Oregonians. And so I would like a review of that market study, whether that's one-on-one or somewhere, because just a kind of a simple example is we did the ERDC and we did minimum wage in Oregon. Whether you support those or not support those, it really isn't the point. The point is we used different zip codes for the same market study of economics, right? If you've got a lower wage somewhere, wouldn't that match up with daycare being paid in that area? Yet we don't use the same zip codes for those two programs. Why? You don't have to answer that.
I know the person who can answer that, and I already have been working to get her in front of this committee. So,
okay.
Representative?
Thank you. And this goes along the lines of other questions. You asked one, but can you give us an overview on how the dollars are allocated to the program services? So the three, if I remember right, it was $366.25 million that you had up in a slide earlier that went directly to program services?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how are they allocated? You know, is it, you know, districts are based on students, right? Yeah. AD and W.
So that covers the full range of programs that are administered by the division. So there might be slightly different answers for different programs. I will give you one example, and I'm not going to get all of the details right, but I'll at least to give you the gist of it. So for the early learning hubs, the Early Learning Council created a funding formula that attempted to balance both looking at making sure that there was a basic floor for all communities, so that if you were a really sparsely low population rural community, that there was a basic amount that you received, and then also balancing that with a formula looking at the number of at-risk children in that community. So that was just one attempt to sort of figure out how we do that balancing between looking at population, but also recognizing that rural populations, a simple population formula doesn't address the higher cost associated with greater distances and things like that. So it's a little bit different. What those formulas are and the history of those differs a little bit from programs, but what the general approach that the division has been taking and the council has been trying to sort of balance those two features.
So I want to get into the weeds.
Yeah.
If I may.
So before you do that, so I apologize to this committee. So all, what you're asking is absolutely the types of stuff we want to talk about. But we're a little out of sync with how we plan to ask or do that, because this is going to be the overview, and then we're going to really get down into it with the programs and that. And I didn't realize you hadn't seen this, because we haven't talked to the speaker yet about our next ones. But as David and they've intimated, we're going to really get into each one of the programs more and understand those details over the next several weeks. We've got a pretty extensive schedule, but we haven't got this approved yet to do that. Once we've had our meeting on Friday, the speaker, my intent would be to share it with all of you so you can see what we're trying to do and then get your questions so you can look at those and see if you think we've got those covered in there, and if we're not, we need to invite somebody else to do it. So it's not the intent. The intent today wasn't to stifle the conversation. It was to kind of start the conversation, but I assure you, we want to have those kind of conversations and get you that kind of information. But
okay.
When we invited David and them here today, we didn't really suggest that they needed to
do it all.
And Chair Lively and committee, I'm also trying to set up individual meetings with all of you so that I can get a sense of some of the questions and what your concerns are so that we can be bringing you the information that you need.
Thank you.
We have a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Chair Lively.
We're going to have a lot of discussion to do.
Anybody have any other questions? Thanks again, and I look forward to continue to have this dialogue.
Way back.
You have to watch me. Placeholder bills. So what we need to be thinking about as we go through here, some of you may already have bills you're working on that would logically come to this committee, which would be great. But we also have placeholder bills, and some of us heard yesterday that we have a lot of placeholder bills to some extent. But given this is a new committee specifically, we have placeholder bills that we put in there that we could use as a committee. So as we're having these conversations, if you think of things.
Rep Evans asked me if I could take his place in being the task force.
Here we go. Seriously.
No, I'm not.
And that's right. I prefer these placeholder bills not be task force, but if we get to it, we have to have a task force. That's supposed to do this. Sorry.
How many was it? Four? Was there five? Four? How many
bills?
Bills were
we had six, didn't we? We have six.
Excuse me.
Dealing with either early childhood or family supports, and you know how the relating clauses can go. But.
Representative Leininger did the same thing for Econ Debt and Trade, so appreciate that, so we don't have to use our...
No, and so I encourage you, as we're having these conversations, there's concepts and things, and we ought to talk about that. So the other thing I would just, because I've already violated the rule some, I guess, is how we function as a committee. My sending out an email to all of you was on the edge of violating a quorum. And all I was trying to do was welcome you to the committee. So we'll have to work through our administrator. And again, I really encourage us to have as much conversation as we can at the ends of each one of these meetings and kind of give the task that we want to do the next time in that. So we get a chance totally to talk about it instead of having to do this one individual thing back and forth each time. But feel free to submit questions in that to Zena as we're going along, and especially once you see, I can see the whole schedule we have of all these conversations. But what happened today is really what I want to see is have these conversations and ask them questions. And what I, you know, this is very complex. We have a large system and a lot of different pieces in different places, and so we need to kind of get wrapped around all of that and see what we can do to move it forward. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, you do a fantastic job. I'm just so lucky to be working with you.
Oh, thank you. I just appreciate that. Okay. We're set. If not, we'll adjourn. We'll adjourn. We're set. If not...